Hello and welcome to Countryside Matters. I'm Jenny Devitt, and in today's programme we'll mostly be talking birds, the birds of Sherborne's Castle Gardens and the swifts of the town's Abbey Bell Tower. We'll also be hearing from Dr. Alex Brown about the medieval climate anomaly, a period of some 300 years in the Middle Ages when this country went through summers of heat and drought. Sound familiar? Stay tuned to learn more. If you're a regular visitor to Sherborne's Castle Gardens, you'll already know about the birds that both visit there and make it their home. Not so long ago, I added to their number with a rescued young blackbird. My sister had the bright idea that I should take it to Castle Gardens as they're so bird-friendly there. Sure enough, one of the most knowledgeable people on the always helpful staff turned out to be Jacob Daly, who took one look at my blackbird, said it was one of this year's brood going through a molt and could fend for itself, and we released it in a hidden garden area. There's a section of the garden centre at the end of the bit where vegetable seedlings are sold, and I met Jacob there again a few days ago.
This is designed to show what a perfect Sherborne garden could look like. So very wildlife friendly, a little veg patch, plenty of seating and all the little things that you could add to make it wildlife friendly. The swift box just put up to kind of give an example alongside other boxes, but the great tits decided that was the perfect one for them.
You obviously were not expecting a swift to come in there, were you?
I mean, No, swift boxes need to be at least 5 metres high off the ground, so they like to nest right up in the eaves. So it was only as a sort of presentation of the number of things, but we've experienced it before where you put up all your nest boxes to show off what's available and they all get occupied and you can't sell them.
But is that the first time that you've had a swift nest box being used by a different bird?
No, it's quite common. Starlings and swifts often occupy similar spaces, so that is quite a common thing. They often get in scrapes with each other, fighting over spaces.
Tell me about it. I have three swift nest boxes in front of my house, and one has been occupied for the last 2 or 3 years by sparrows, and then the middle one has been occupied this year by starlings. But anyway, to come back to these nest boxes, So is this the first time you've had a swift nest box here?
Yes, in this space, yeah, it is, yeah. But we've had wrens. Earlier in the season, we had wrens nesting in the display, but they are actually behind the display. So we've got a little alcove behind the display, which is used for storage. And the wrens have decided that that was a perfect space. Earlier in the year as well, we've also had bird feeders in this space. But we've taken those down following the RSPB's recommendations in May. But before that, yeah, it was very...
Those were the recommendations that you shouldn't actually feed the birds. That you shouldn't actually feed the birds during the summer months.
Yeah.
Risk of disease.
Absolutely, yeah. So changing the habits to feed more seasonally and feed more safely. So we are still providing small bits of food on site, but we've dramatically changed what we're providing and how we're providing it. So we've taken down seed feeders, nut feeders for the summer. We'll reassess and we'll talk to places like Dorset Wildlife Trust and the RSPB in the autumn and see what what the policy will be moving into the winter and how we approach that.
And how do the birds of Castle Gardens feel about this change in the habits of the staff putting up food for them?
Well, to be honest, they seem to be getting on fine. We don't use chemical sprays, we don't use pesticides on site, so this time of year there are lots of insects around. We've got lots of beetles on site, we've got lots of larvae and things, and there's plenty, we leave spaces, so we call the secret garden, and we leave wild spaces, and they're occupied by invertebrates, and that's what the birds should be eating at this time of year anyway. Then they shouldn't be eating peanuts now. It's not in the right season. It's the seed season isn't what they're feeding on, so switching to those more seasonal diets is actually better for the health of the birds. I kind of think of it a bit like fast food for us. It's quick and it's convenient, but not always giving you the best nourishment. And actually, at certain times of year, a greasy burger will fill you up and make you feel, like you've got a bit of energy on a cold winter's day, but maybe not going to give you all of the goodness that you need.
And I suppose, Jacob, that when it comes to young birds looking for food,
You want them to be out there learning to forage and hunt and not be relying on something that's the fast food, the takeaway.
Exactly, yeah. There's disease that can spread between, and that's why the RSPB has made its statement now that there is a real problem, especially in finches, which is being spread through bird feeders specifically, and that's going to be worse in the summer. But also the mortality rate of birds that are growing up on bird feeders is much, much higher because they haven't built up a resource to learn how to defend for themselves, how to feed for themselves. And when it comes through to hard times, if you go away on holiday and don't put out food when they've got nothing left to sustain them. So it's about balancing those things. It's about having native invertebrates that the birds can eat. It's about allowing caterpillars to come in and eat some of your broccoli, and, you know, knowing that a baby blue tit will eat around about 2,000 caterpillars before it fledges in about 3 or 4 weeks. So that's a huge amount of food that's needed to get that chick, you know, from hatching into fledging. And more that is being lost from our countryside. It's being lost from our hedgerows, and the spaces where we can provide that is in our gardens. We can allow a little bit of it. You know, we can protect some of our brassicas and we can protect some of our things, but we can also allow some space for those things in our gardens as well, because otherwise we will lose those birds.
I love the way you say we can allow the caterpillars to eat our brassica. Then you just, in the case of mine last year and the year before, you just have these naked stalks.
Yeah, you do sometimes. But things like, for example, nasturtiums, the small white, large white butterflies, they'll love those and they'll feed on those. So if you want to, you could put an insect net over your prized vegetables, and you could grow nasturtiums next to them and leave those exposed. And my belief is that we too much focus on nature living in a nature reserve and humans living in the town, and actually we need to coexist. We need to work together, creating space for all of those things. It's our garden, but it's also theirs, and balancing those spaces and allowing space for both of those activities.
And sharing them. Come back to what your policy of not using insecticides in this, in Castle Gardens. Mm. Have you noticed that there's been, I mean, we know there's an insect apocalypse pretty much everywhere. Mm. Have you noticed an increase in insects this year at all?
Yeah, this year's been very good. I think, again, the warm weather makes it often very noticeable. You see a lot more flying insects. We've got a lot of moths on site. We've got a lot of butterflies, beetles. We get dragonflies. I mean, we're very lucky that we're surrounded by the Newcastle and the Old Castle. And then we've got Purley Meadow as well next to us. So there's a lot of green space around us as well. But we've also allowed those spaces within the centre. So behind little areas, spaces behind the bedding tunnels, where it's allowed space for things like nettles to grow, which, you know, as gardeners, we're not supposed to like, but they're an important part of our native flora. And they, yeah, a lot of things like to live in them, and a lot of things like to eat them. So where we've got that space and where we can allow that to exist, we do. And we find that you then get natural pest control, if you like. So your birds come in and eat, but we've got frogs and toads on site. And we've got all sorts of things that come out of the, you know, literally out of the woodwork sometimes and eat the undesirables and help us.
But not woodworm, hopefully. No. I can see Mike sort of heaving into view down there. So let's go up, because when I brought you that blackbird last week, or was it last week or a few days ago, you released it in that secret garden. Mike, the secret garden of one of them, of Castle Gardens, a bit of a jungle.
Yeah, it is.
From
well,
what I saw.
And actually, it is a bit of a jungle, and that's what we keep it as. So a nice a wildlife sump or a no-go area, really, and it's full of all sorts of things. It's an interesting area because when they built walled gardens like this, they were absolute experts in controlling climate without any of the sort of modern techniques that we've got to do it. So there's a, it's a very narrow stretch of wall. Interestingly, when we first arrived here, back in 19... first time I saw the site was in 1986, and we looked over the wall thinking we would look into the main part of the site and actually looked into the secret garden. And we said to Sherborne Castle Estates, is that part of our property that we're taking on? And they didn't know it existed because it had been so overgrown, the whole site was so overgrown. We eventually have found the door into there. So it's a wonderful piece, but they're very different, very calm environment in there. So it's great for wildlife. And so the your blackbird that arrived last week, I woke up being disturbed by an extra loud dawn chorus.
I don't believe
I thought,
you.
I thought, do you know what? There's one more bird out there today. No, there was. So it was nice to be able to adopt him.
That's a very high wall, isn't it? And a similar height of wall on the other side?
Slightly lower on the other side, which again, because that is south facing, and what we're looking at here, there's trees in there now and a big copper beech the other side, which will be shading it as it wouldn't have been shaded when it was built. The higher wall here may have even had some lean-to greenhouses on, but certainly if we went the other side, which you can't really at the moment, but there's lots of nails in the walls where they would have trained fruit trees and grapes and various climbers. Perfectly south-facing, though, so just beautiful space for growing all sorts of exotic things.
Yeah, there was a kiwi bush in there. When we were putting up the solar panels, we had to cut back some of it. Last year, we were clearing space to get access to the roof to put up solar panels, and there was a huge, very old kiwi.
Yeah, so the kiwi is old from our point of view, so I think that would have been planted back in the 80s. Right. And it's in what's known as the Rose Walk, which is what's outside, but it loves it in that spot. It absolutely adores it, so it's a lovely... lovely climate.
Does it give you any fruit?
Occasionally, but it probably is that the summer this year will be long enough to ripen them, but you get them to a perfect stage from the size of fruit, but they're never actually quite ripe enough without a bit of extra protection to be as sweet as you might like for eating.
Mike, tell me, the fact that it's got this very high wall and a slightly lower wall the other side, does that make it cat-proof? Because obviously if we're going to be releasing foundling birds in there and there are others that already are living there, they would like to be predator-free.
Yeah, well, probably not. Cats are so intrepid, aren't they? But actually it's interesting because if you're out here, particularly in the quiet of the evening, and if there is a cat around, you can tell the birds are all telling each other that there's a cat around. So you hear there's a change of tone. What's also interesting is when we have our wonderful Birds of Prey Day, it's interesting how the noise from the birds changes when they are in here sitting quite calmly. But they know straight away that there are potential predators around. So interesting how they all talk to each other at that stage. So... but it's a nice protected spot for them, but cats will get just about anywhere, I think.
Yeah, sadly. But it's interesting, this Mike was just saying, Jacob, that even though the birds of prey, which were here for display, were immobile, as it were, sitting on their perches, that the all resident birds could tell they were there. How?
It's often silhouettes, but they'll find out, they'll know these things, but they're attuned to it. We get quite a lot of birds of prey on site or around the site anyway, so they've grown up, as we were talking about earlier. You learn your defense mechanisms, you learn to recognize. We get sparrow hawks coming through the site, which is really exciting. We've had a few get themselves stuck inside, but mostly there you see them outside. But we've seen owls here, especially in the winter when it gets dark earlier. There's buzzards, there's red kites, and we've even got peregrines that have been spotted over at the old castle. We know we've got a resident pair over in Yeovil.
On St John's Church.
On St John's Church, yeah. But it's not a big stretch for a bird to fly this far. They've been seen at the old castle with surveys that are going on there at the moment. So that area is being monitored by a team of volunteers who are all looking at what wildlife is on site, and improvements that can be made to the how that area is managed to better support wildlife, both on that site but also in Sherborne as a whole.
It's lovely, isn't it, Mike? I mean, here you are at Castle Gardens. We're surrounded by greenery, but lots of people come here, and lots come for the sake of the birds, I believe.
Yes, they do, yeah. And people, you know, really interested, really, really approve of the things that we're trying to do. But also, you know, as Jacob will say, we'll know because he'll be the one that gets asked, but an awful lot of people talking about birds and wanting to share their experience with the birds. Brian's also a real wild bird expert, and so just sort of sharing ideas and thoughts and viewings of the whole thing. And it's it is wonderful and how interested people are. But it's a sort of it's an indicator of our interest in, you know, in running the site as sustainably as we can, and it does create, you know, wonderful habitat for that. And it was interesting in COVID times, actually, how quickly the whole site got inside, was suddenly taken over by all sorts of birds who were then very irritated when customers started coming back. So they would make nests behind, in the shelves and up in the roofs, and just they were quite pleased that the COVID restrictions, they just had a whale of a time doing it. But anyway, so they do treat the site as their own. And we've got the robin, you've probably spoken about that knows how to open the automatic door.
This is a lovely story.
Well, Jake, you'd like to tell the story.
Well, so we've got, we call him Luigi, but I think in reality there might be about 100 of them that have, are coming in and around the site. We've got a few that we've found nests for around the site. So some have been in the bedding tunnels where we've been, we've got some out the back in the yard. But we've in the greenhouse, and it was particularly noticeable earlier in the year when things were a little bit colder, and the robin had worked out how to trigger the automatic door sensor, so by flying up and pecking at it, would open the doors and you could come in and come into the greenhouse and find food. So we started putting out a little bit of food for it, and it would come in every day.
And it worked out how to get out again.
And
too,
it worked
obviously.
Out how to get out again. Yes, and we'd often find two robins, one on either side of the door, shouting at each other, they're establishing their territories. And but now we get a lot of blackbirds as well. Now that summer's very definitely here, we've got to keep all the doors open, try and keep everything ventilated, and so we get a lot more birds coming through into that space now as well. The robins are still around, but we get blackbirds. And again, they chase each other around, and
because, of course, you've got all the customers come here. Those birds are not afraid of people, presumably. The presence of people is not going to chase them away.
Yeah, they're cautious, but they seem to be a lot tamer than you would perhaps find in other places.
It's lovely, Mike. I mean, this is so encouraging, isn't it? Particularly if we're going to carry on having summers like this, hot and dry, long dry spells, birds need all the sort of green spaces and help that they can find.
Absolutely, yes, and food sources, you know, why gardens are a haven for wildlife, and if they're planted in the right way, and that doesn't mean that you have to make everything, you know, a jungle. You can plant and it can look like a contemporary garden, very neat, can win lots of awards, but actually by doing the right things, planting the right plants, insect encouraging plants, but also plants that bury, and also places where birds and other animals can feel safe, I think is a great thing to do. And also it looks after us in terms of, you know, temperatures. So one of the interesting things here on site, in the middle of the centre where we've got the big established trees, we've started to bring restaurant tables under there.
I noticed that the other day. I thought, what a perfect place to sit and have your cup of coffee.
Absolutely, and it just shows the power of permanent shade can be generated from trees. So in the main restaurant garden where we've got parasols, that's rather nice. But of course the sun moves round, and so the paving underneath warms up. but underneath these trees it's permanently shaded, so actually it's cool under there, naturally cool under there, and it's just a lovely place to be. But it just shows how important plants are for keeping our buildings cool, keeping our gardens cool, and I think that's so, even on the hottest days, it's really nice and cool under there.
And good, of course, Jacob, for the birds.
Yeah, we've also found spaces under there. You'll come in and see the blackbirds and the robins. We've got song thrushes. There's all sorts of things, and they're all hiding in that same space, you know, taking advantage of that cooler conditions. And I think Mike's absolutely right that the birds are often the visual. They're very colourful, they're very loud. We see those, but it's actually there's a whole ecosystem that's happening underneath that you're not seeing. Your healthy soil and, you know, those things that are supporting that network. So if we want to see those birds, we have to think about the whole system all the way down, how we care for every part of our garden, how we, you know, our watering techniques, whether we're using, you know, harvesting rainwater like we are on site here, or all of those things that are feeding back into the health of your garden. Again, we can think about that. The health of ourselves, like how we care for every part of ourselves. Are we looking after our natural systems, and are we taking care of all of those different things? And that's going to benefit the overall health, and that will bring in the songbirds, that'll bring in the other things that we like to see, and it'll bring in the apex predators as well. So it's a whole system.
Well, we get so much more enjoyment. And finally, Mike, I gather you've also had a rather good beetle year here at Castle Gardens.
Yeah, lots of beetles that sometimes customers will bring them in for us to identify, which is really rather good. But there's lots of beetles around at the moment. And now I'm going to have a mental blank as to the varieties, but the ones that are flying at the moment, we're starting to see lots of those around. But that's really encouraging, seeing them and having people interested in them as well.
Lesser stag beetles were one we found last week.
Yeah.
So yeah, and they were in amongst the hostas, but they'll live in rotting wood. So it's actually where we've got some old bits of wood to show a sort of what you might do in a fernery or something like that. So as we were caring for those, we found some lesser stag beetles. We got violet ground beetles. We found quite a few other bits and pieces. Yeah, they're, you know, big impressive insects.
Wonderful. Maybe you'll get some real stag beetles.
Lots of butterflies.
Who is this? Mike's just showing me a picture of the cinnabar moth, which, of course,
actually, it's not cinnabar.
Jersey tiger.
Jersey tiger.
Yeah, we've got cinnabars as well.
The Jersey tiger, which, when its wings open, is that lovely scarlet flash, isn't
there? Yeah, absolutely. And I waited and waited, but it wouldn't fly off, so I couldn't get a picture of it properly. But
so
it
didn't take a twig and prod it gently.
Yeah, come on. Yes, fly. But there are huge numbers. A good year for butterflies and moths, I think, as well.
Yeah, the survey was done here a few years ago, but we had over 100 species of moth that were found on site using moth traps and things. So yeah, there's a lot around, but we do have to be aware that we're also, it's a shifting baseline. So it's been a very good year this year, but comparatively we're a long way from where we could be, and that's something to kind of consider, is what we can do to continue those positive trends.
But on a final note, Jacob, I have a large buddleia, self-seated, of course, as they mostly are, outside my dining room window, and I noticed the night before last that there were lots of moths on it. So we forget that moths are really good pollinators too.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, moths are really, really important, and they are a vital food source as well. So the moths themselves will be eaten by, obviously, bats, but swifts, which I know you love, they will eat moths. You often see them gathering in the evenings, and they're often be feeding on those as well. But also the caterpillars of those moths as well are vital for the smaller birds. And again, the diversity of moths, they'll need a diversity of habitat. They'll need a diversity of food plants. They've all got very specialist ways of feeding. So both the adults that love different types of plants. So buddleia will be really attractive to certain types of moth, but actually long grass can be really attractive to other types of moth. So it's that, again, it's that diversity of habitat that will bring in that range of wildlife, and then each of those different types of wildlife will bring in different predators and, you know, all your different birds that come in to feed on those different things. And the grasses that maybe also provide seeds, or leaving dandelions to grow in certain places that will bring in
gold. Well, you can eat the dandelions too, of course.
Yeah, and the goldfinches and all the other things that come in to feed on those as well later in the year. So it's a really nice...
And finally, Mike, I know that you don't really have a building, do you, except possibly your house here at Castle Grounds that's tall enough for you to put swift nest boxes, because then you could get an overspill from the abbey, couldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Yeah, and we went up the tower of the abbey on last week, and just fascinating there how many swifts are flying around when you get up to the top, and also seeing the nesting boxes in amongst the bells. And when we were there, the noise from the swifts was louder than the bells, but anyway, the
that was just as well for your hearing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, but no, it's good to see, you know, the attention that swifts are being given. And as Jacob was saying earlier on, you know, we might be on a little peak on these things because of the conditions this year, but actually it's the underlying trends that we've got to be aware of. And I thought also a really important point that, of course, pollinators, you know, bees are the poster boys and girls of pollinators, but actually there's loads and loads of others that do that job. And important that we support, find ways of supporting them all, because they are just a vital part of the environment, the ecosystem.
Managing Director of the Gardens Group, Mike Burks, and staff member, Jacob Daly. The swift nest boxes that Mike said he'd seen up in the Sherborne Abbey bell tower were made by tower captain Tim Phillips. I spoke to him and to Steve Day, who started the group Swifts Over Sherborne, to get an update. Tim came along with a printout of a graph and told me what it showed.
It is telling us how many birds have visited any of our 30 boxes over the past period from the 9th of May, when they first arrived into a box, to yesterday. So we've got 30 boxes up there in three houses, three blocks. The original house is in the north side of the tower. There is a new house in the west side, and a new house in the east side of the abbey.
So which are considered to be the more desirable residences as far as the swifts are concerned?
Last year's two pairs who bred returned to the north side of the abbey, north house, this year. We've had birds in seven of those 10 boxes. We've got three breeding pairs. A new breeding pair set up home on the 18th of June. They have been in it every day since. They built an initially rather rudimentary nest. And the story of Box 8 is quite interesting. We saw them building the nest, and then one egg appeared towards the end of June. And the following morning, it wasn't there anymore, and neither were the birds. So I thought, I'll go and have a look. So when I opened the box, there were two eggs by the front wall of the box, had obviously been taken out of the nest. So I thought, well, what's the worst that can happen? So I put them back. That evening, they were accompanied by a third newly laid egg. A couple of days later, we found that the bird who had been brooding them had turfed one out. And I'm sure it's in there somewhere, but we can't see it on the camera image. But yesterday I was able to confirm that she is still brooding two eggs, and they're due to hatch any minute.
Well, could it be that she rejected the other egg because she sensed that it was infertile?
I think it's more likely that the male bird has two partners. This happens in swift life just like it does in humans. And we've seen evidence of that. There was a BBC Spring Watch clip, which is on YouTube, The Secret Life of Swifts. Fascinating. I urge your listeners to watch it because it is really good. And there was evidence in that of lots of billing and cooing in an inappropriate manner by an interloper. And we think that's what's happened here. He has mated with two hens. And the one who decided she was going to stay and look after her eggs turfed the other one out.
Isn't it interesting, Steve, that they can actually sense that, you know, in the egg stage? I mean, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's I like the drama of it, and it's, as Tim said, it's not much different to our own society and way of being, really. They've got their own methods and rules and preferences and changes, and they clearly have often changed partners. But it's exciting. I love that this graph that Tim has compiled gives us a really clear picture of how they are engaging with the boxes and how that's changing and how they're getting into it a bit more. And as we've seen, some of the nesting materials that have appeared, which won't produce young this year, but I feel quite confident, I think Tim does too, that next year we will see more and more families, because I think that's a part of what they do, is they will test a place out, they'll go and stay in it. As we've seen, there's quite a few roosting overnight. And hopefully next year we will see even more. I mean, we've seen loads of swifts, what you call banging, around the outside of the tower, near to the entrances of the boxes, hooking on and clinging on for a few seconds before they fly back, and then coming back again and again. And we've seen several evenings where there's a cloud of swifts hanging around the tower, chasing each other around, but lots of them stopping around where the new boxes are. So as Tim said, I think we have 30 boxes up there, and there will be another 10 over this winter going up, and they'll probably go in the east face, which will give us two boxes there, because that seems to have been the most popular spot for reconnoitering and visiting. So we'll see.
So what are they actually doing when they're banging? I mean, what's the purpose of that?
I think it's just testing out the hole. Maybe they want to see if other swifts are already located in them. As we've seen on that wildlife programme Tim just alluded to, I think there was quite a bit of ruckus and to do with them when they, you know, they'd pop in and they'd find other swifts were there. So maybe they're just a bit cautious, or they want to know that when they land, it feels safe. Maybe they test the flight back out, because they need quite a bit of room to launch into their flights, and for their young to be able to launch their first flights. So I think it's probably, I mean, I am not a scientist, and I'm a layperson as far as swifts goes, but I think that's probably what's occurring, is that they are researching their home, as soon as they can't go down to Foxton's and have a look in the windows.
Yeah, it's a bit like us going and going on looking on Right Movies and to see what properties are available, I suppose. Yeah. So Tim, given that I understand that swallows pair for life, quite obviously from what you've been saying, the promiscuous behaviour, if one could call it that, of that particular male, would indicate that swifts don't pair for life.
I ought to say that my interpretation of what happened in Box 8 is an assumption. However, the BBC Spring Watch programme confirmed that the theory that swifts are monogamous for life is not necessarily true. Indeed, we think we saw something similar last year with Box 2, where at one point there were two eggs in the nest and then there were none, and then another one was laid, probably by a different female. There could be several reasons why they would throw out two earlier eggs. Maybe a partner died or was killed, maybe just unfaithful, which is what we think happened last year. And indeed, we found those two eggs in the box at the end of the season. So it's likely that the received wisdom of monogamy is not totally accurate. And it's quite exciting to be in a position to maybe disprove some of the theories about these birds, or maybe add some further information to what's already held.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the fact that you built these nest boxes and you're observing everything very closely, Steve, means that you can be presumably adding to the existing knowledge about swifts.
Well, Tim's data definitely is. I should add at this point that I was the protagonist and the instigator for this project, but Tim has done so much of the work since, building the boxes, observing them, checking on things, trying to get the Wi-Fi to work. And I also like the sort of the non-precious sort of approach to observing wildlife as well, where it's, the scene with Box 2, as we've said, and we put on Instagram last year, was a scene of domestic chaos. And what looked like sort of divorce, abandonment of children, mess, there was unmentionables everywhere. And then Box 10, who I commented, again in layman terms, but I said, surely these guys have done it before, because it was so neat. There was no hassle, the two kids were fledged without problem. But Box 2 was just a mess. It was hilarious, but that, you know, there was loads of drama, and I just thought, well, I don't think any of wildlife is any different much to us at its visceral core.
It's really something of a soap opera that you've been witnessing, isn't it, Tim?
It is. Last evening I was watching, what's the fella's name?
Chris Packham?
Chris Packham, thank you. Chris Packham doing his evolution, and his theory, the way he's propounded the theory, was that we're all descended from a very common, very small, very...
A blob
of matter in an ocean. And it seems that swifts and us haven't diverged too far.
you talked about the sort of preliminary nesting. Steve, does it look as if they, the swifts who won't nest this year but are investigating, inspecting, going to Swift Right Move to see what might be available for next year, do they sort of build, would they build a rudimentary experimental nest which wouldn't serve any purpose, but they might come back and embellish it next year?
Yeah, it seems like they are doing that, because there's various stages and contents in the boxes, and some of it looks quite wildly obscure, and some they've placed a few feathers, and some have sort of lined, semi-lined the concaves. But it's hard to tell how accurate that would be by observing, but I would feel pretty confident that that is the case, that they are doing preliminary, you know, research and checking out, like we would, checking out their new spaces and whether they, you know, whether the kitchen sink will go over there in the left or...
Descending into the realms of frivolity here. Tell me, are you feeding any of this data? We should call it data, should we not? Mm. Are you feeding any of this back to any scientific body, or the RSPB, or anything like that?
No, not yet. This is early days with this. This is the first season we've collected this sort of data. What we are doing is that I wrote to the BTO and asked if there was anybody who could come and ring the young in the nest, and I was contacted by the gloriously named Piddle Valley Bird Ringing Group, Ed and Kate. If you're listening, Ed and Kate, thank you very much. They've been twice so far, and they're going to come probably in about a fortnight's time and ring the two birds in Box 8. So if a dead swift is found with a ring on it and it's one of ours, it'll be recorded as such. That the information about ringing is recorded in a database somewhere, I'm not sure where it is. The other thing we thought about doing was tagging them. You can put a harness on a swift, would you believe, with a little transmitter receiver on its back. We could have picked up satellite data from that, but there were two problems with that. One is that we would have to catch the bird in order to download the data, which is not an attractive proposition.
Something of a challenge. Well, they're quite fast, always in the air, and very fast.
Well, yes. Even if we caught it in the box, you know, if you open the box, it'd be straight out the door, if you like, and gone. And the other was that the thinnest one is 6 meters. Six millimeters deep, strapped to its back. But the one that we would have liked to put on for the GPS is 12 millimeters. And that, added to the bird itself, may not get through the hole that we've built for them.
So
there were two good reasons why not to do it, but it would have been fascinating to find out where the Sherborne swifts actually go.
You know, this is all absolutely wonderful and very encouraging, isn't it, Steve? Real vindication of the fact that you set up swifts for Sherborne a couple of years back.
Well, it's just exciting, and it's a joy. and they have sort of just, they've taken on the boxes, which is wonderful. There was, of course, already a colony of sorts here, but I would say positively, it definitely looks like they have grown slightly in number over the last couple of years. We had an evening where I think we could have all counted at least 60 or 70 in the vicinity of the tower, and that was really exciting. And that is the idea of the project, is to give them a permanent sort of space and encourage more nesting and such. It's also important because we've had a couple of buildings in Sherborne that have had the new soffits and fascias fitted, and they've closed off the holes completely. You know, not to point fingers, but it's just if they don't know, and if we weren't there to sort of forewarn and suggest and advise, then nothing's done really. So it's great in that respect, is that we've established that Swifts Over Sherborne does have a presence and a use for the Abbey's Swift population. Effectively, they've always seems to have been based around the Abbey. They were roosting a lot in the school connected to the Abbey in the roofs there, because they're so ancient. And it's just a relief to think that we have offered them an alternative, and we're hoping that the ones that get into their boxes locally in other buildings have been able to see the colony around the tower, and that they will replace and, you know, move more to that nesting place.
And of course the word of this success will have got round most of the town by now, and the environs, and encourage other people to do what they can to help Swifts, won't it, Tim?
Yes, I'm sure it will. Just to pick up on one of Steve's points, I was extremely glad to be contacted by a firm of ecologists who are working for Sherborne Boys' School. One of their buildings, which abuts the Abbey on the north side, has a stone roof which is leaking, and it's leaking above the library, in which there is a famous ancient Bible, and understandably they want to do something about it. And the ecologists got in touch with Swifts Over Sherborne, and I was able to agree with them that we would be able to tell them when the last Swifts had gone, when they could start on the work to replace the roof. And pleasingly, although they're going to put scaffolding up during August to the height of the gutters, which is therefore below where the Swifts are, we will identify when they start the work where the nests are, and they have committed to leaving holes in the new structure, not so that the rain will come in as it does now, but so that the birds can gain access to the sites that they used before.
So, hopefully, lots more Swifts in Sherborne next year. That was Tim Phillips and Steve Day of Swifts Over Sherborne. I read a really fascinating article recently about something called the Medieval Climate Anomaly, or Medieval Warm Period. This was news to me, and very surprising to read that we've been here before, as it were, with what's going on with today's climate, though not quite. In his article, Dr. Alex Brown revealed the fact that centuries ago, we went through a time in which there was often drought, water shortages, crop failures, and excessive summer heat. Did that medieval warm period, I wondered, compare with what we're increasingly experiencing, and was it all negative?
It's similar in some ways and different in other ways. So I think that's in some ways it's one of those difficult things of trying to communicate to people, is that the medieval warm period as a whole was largely beneficial to medieval agriculture, but that it did produce some of these extremes that are, you know, largely similar to what we're seeing today.
But it was a warm period that went on for several centuries, kind of starting in about 900, was that right?
Yeah, so roughly from the kind of 9th century through to the mid-13th century, there is this that largely called the medieval warm period. It largely affects Northern Europe and some parts of the globe, but it's importantly, it's not a universal kind of global warming event, so it doesn't affect everywhere equally. But it does see a period of sustained climatic stability and warmer weather.
And warmer summer weather and wetter winters? I mean, is there any parallel to what we've been experiencing the last few years?
Very, very similar in many, many ways. The biggest difference is it's probably similar to what we were seeing in the kind of 1990s, maybe even the early 2000s. I think the really big change has been in the last decade or two is something where even in the medieval warm period, we're seeing unprecedented things today. And I think that's the important thing to really think about is, yes, climate does vary naturally and it has varied historically. But what we're seeing today is distinctly different. Records are tumbling in ways that even going back to the Middle Ages, they were not like they are today.
Well, it was pretty much all agreed, apart from those few climate deniers who hopefully are becoming fewer in number by the day, that our current conditions, our current changing weather is human-induced. But back then, in that medieval period, that was not the case, was it?
No, completely. It wasn't human-induced. It was natural variations in the climate. So this is natural variations in solar irradiance. So this is basically the amount of energy that the sun gives out to Earth that comes down to the planet, but also a lack of volcanic activity. So volcanic activity, I don't know if you remember from the kind of Icelandic dust clouds that go up in the atmosphere, they have a cooling effect. So if you have a large volcanic eruptions, they have an overall cooling effect on the environment. So for centuries, there is a reduction in volcanic activity and an increase in solar irradiance. And this produces this, you know, in many ways, it's a kind of sweet spot for medieval agriculture. But it does then have some consequences of particularly severe droughts at some times.
But you said, talking of volcanic eruptions, and just to sort of step sideways for a moment, their impact, of course, on climate, on weather, is significant, isn't it? I mean, was it the eruption of Krakatoa in Indonesia back in, was it 1813, that caused a summer, a year of darkness, and all the crops failed, and it was pretty catastrophic?
Yeah, I mean, so if you search the worst year to be alive, it's largely thought of to be 536. So in 536 AD, there is basically a volcanic winter, and it's said by contemporary chroniclers to send, you know, a year of darkness. Probably slightly exaggerating, but it is a global environmental effect from this volcanic eruption. So it's certainly happened before in that way.
It was obviously a mighty explosion if it had a global effect.
Yeah, and its impact can be seen widely across ice core data and any number of different proxies of climate. So ice cores are basically drilled down into the Arctic or Antarctic ice or into any kind of glacier and pull out these massive cores of ice that go back, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of years. And you can see layer by layer the amount of volcanic dust, the amount of sulfur, the amount of all sorts of different things that are present within the atmosphere.
You mentioned that, and of course the science of that and of counting tree rings, dendrochronology, this is modern science backing up that medieval warm period.
100%. This is the latest scientific evidence demonstrating that we can see in almost every proxy of data changes in growing conditions. So it's not just, for example, temperature. It's also the amount of rainfall. And as I say, when you get towards the ice cores, you then start to deal with atmospheric conditions as well. So these enable scientists for decades now to really reconstruct historic climate with a really good level of accuracy now.
It's marvellous, isn't it? Is there any way, Alex, of knowing whether the high temperatures that chroniclers of that medieval period, in the warm period, wrote about were similar to ours today? I mean, are there temperature records?
So not from the primary records themselves. So chroniclers, for example, talk of in 1252, they talk of, you know, from about March through to July that there's not a drop of rain. This in many ways sounds quite familiar to today. They talk about some of those kind of, you know, weather conditions, but obviously they don't record temperature, not to the accuracy that we would talk about. What we can do is, from that climate proxy data, is if you have enough data points, you can start to then reconstruct what temperatures were like. And what scientists tend to do is, instead of presenting it as the extremes, because obviously it can vary from year to year, they tend to have benchmarks of decades, so maybe two or three decades together. And in that sense, the medieval warm period would have been warmer probably than the weather we were experiencing from the 1960s to the 1990s. So we know as a large kind of period that it was experiencing temperatures equivalent to things that we've experienced in our lifetimes. But that, in the last kind of two, probably at least the last two decades, temperatures are probably higher than they ever were in the medieval warm period.
And it was warm enough, as you say in your article, for vineyards to flourish in southern Britain.
Yeah, so there's vineyards, there's all sorts of different agriculture. I mean, you can see it even in terms of surviving archaeology, that people are farming at elevations that are simply not viable even today, really. So people must have, the climate must have been at least in some way beneficial to that, enabling people to produce, you know, arable agriculture at elevations that simply would not have been viable several centuries later.
And of course, because that meant there was more food produced, that meant you had an increased population, I assume.
100%. So this is across the 11th, 12th, into the early 13th century, population booms across the whole of Europe, parts of Asia. In England, it at least doubles, maybe even triples. There's lots of different estimates of population size. But by around the year 1300, the population's maybe anywhere between about maybe 4.5 million up to about 6 million are the kind of estimates. And that's increased from about maybe around 1.5 million at the time of Doomsday Book in the 11th century. So we know that this is a period of substantial population growth. And the problem is what happens next, because you end up with this really quite heavily populated, at least at the time, quite heavily populated island, that then what happens when the climate turns. And that's what we see at the end of the 13th century.
And so you're getting these increased droughts and crops failing, and therefore having to import. And as you say in your article, one of the things that the undesirables that was imported was the Black Death.
Yeah, so this is really with that changing climatic conditions from the late medieval warm period into what's generally thought of as the Little Ice Age in the early modern period. But the 14th century is really that transition between them. So you end up with a massive volcanic eruption in the 1260s that leads to the deaths of potentially, you know, tens of thousands of people in London, even leads to kind of famine in parts of the city. That then into the early 14th century, with that change in climate, what you end up with is the reverse of what I was just talking about. So instead of this really sustained medieval warm period, you get extensive rainfall in the spring and summer of 1315. And in many ways, as horrible as drought is, as horrible as kind of warm weather is, to a certain extent, the climate in the UK, it's still possible in some ways to produce, you know, agricultural outputs. In the 14th century, when you've got extensive spring and summer rain, and I do mean, they talked about it basically almost biblical levels of rain, that it was raining every single day. It was never warm enough for any grain to germinate, for any grain to come to fruition. It basically meant you had an absolute crop failure in 1315. And that happens again in 1316 and again in 1317. And this is known as the Great Famine of the early 14th century, and probably about 10% of the European population dies. So although the medieval warm period had its moments, it's really actually that transitional period of the late 14th century that disaster really strikes.
And you mentioned in your article that there was an increase, or talk of an increase, that the chroniclers relate that there was an increase in biting insects and fleas and so on. And personally, from my own personal experience this summer, I do think there are more biting insects around.
100%. I mean, this is certainly something they mention, especially in the marshland, especially in the fens. They talk about extensively of you know, any number of insects. They talk about cattle disease as well. But the insects especially are thought to be related to malaria. So malaria was endemic in parts of England, in the certainly in the kind of Roman period and probably into the Middle Ages. And it's only relatively recently that it's really died out in the UK.
With this warming, there was a from what you say in your article, there was a reduction in the amount of Arctic ice, and so the fact that it shrank meant that the Norse people could happily go across and colonize Iceland and Greenland and reach North America.
Yeah, so it leads to new exploration as well. It's that kind of, you know, rising temperatures, declining sea ice, but also stability of that transatlantic crossing that enables it, because ultimately the waves aren't as serious, there aren't as many winter storms, so it's a kind of nice perfect trifecta of different conditions enables them to go further than ever before.
What it really all says, doesn't it, Alex, is that the weather systems and the climate of this planet of ours are so complex. And even though we understand an awful lot, there's a great degree of unpredictability, and we mess with it at our peril, don't we?
I mean, 100%. And I think the main takeaway for me of this kind of reconstructing historic climate and understanding how people have dealt with some of these conditions previously is not to say, well, it's happened before, therefore it's not our fault now, and ultimately this has all happened before, it will happen again, we're not to blame. It's to say, yes, it has happened before, yes, it can happen naturally, but what's happening today is unprecedented, it is different, and you know, we need to start thinking about ways of really taking that seriously, and that reconstructing this historically demonstrates just how much is different in the last probably at least two decades from what has gone before.
That was Dr. Alex Brown, who's Associate Professor of Late Medieval History at Durham University. And with that, we come to the end of today's Countryside Matters. Thanks for listening, and thanks to the Gardens Group for supporting the programme. This is Jenny Devitt saying goodbye until next time.